Welcome to Pediatric Insight, where we have candid conversations with members of the Child Health Advisory Council and some of the nation's top academic child health leaders. I am Wesley Milliken, CEO of Career Physician, and your host. Each conversation addresses a leadership challenge or opportunity that's top of mind for today's pediatric leaders. The council breaks it down based on the wisdom and experience obtained throughout their distinguished careers. And now, I'm honored to turn it over to the moderator in today's conversation.
Thank you so much for joining us for today's Pediatric Insight. My name is Dr. Danielle LaRocca-Rina, and I am a Child Health Council member and current professor in epidemiology and pediatrics at the Mailman School of Public Health and the Vigilos College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University and president emerita of SUNY Upstate Medical University. I want to thank our guest speakers, Dr. Lisa Eiland and Dr. Colin Orr, who have joined us this morning. Dr. Eiland is Division Chief of Neonatology at the Hackensack Meridian Children's Health at Joseph M. Senzari Children's Hospital. Thank you, and she'll have an opportunity to extend that introduction. Dr. Eiland had the pleasure of being faculty together and knowing each other for a long time, and her wisdom and experience really will be valuable to this conversation. Dr. Colin Orr is a general pediatrician and health services researcher at Vanderbilt University. So we have some geographic distribution in our comments. He also played a lead role in the recent pediatric subspecialty workforce report and has published in academic journals on the topic of a pediatric workforce. I want to acknowledge my co-council members joining us today, Dr. Bruder Stapleton, Dr. Arnold Strauss, Dr. Bob Serwin, and Dr. Craig Hellemeyer, and Wesley Milliken. Thank you so much, and we hope to have a robust discussion. So let's begin. As I reflected on today's topic, it is clear that pediatric workforce with character, caring, and commitment to academic excellence is essential to continuously improve the health status of child population in the United States. I'm not saying anything you don't know, but I do want you to notice the three C's of character, caring, and commitment to academic excellence. Today in particular, we discuss the topic of engaging underrepresented in medicine students, those who are making critical decisions about their career path, to address the diverse needs of our child population. We are fortunate that the Child Health Council is joined, as I mentioned, by Dr. Eiland, and we're going to switch to informal Lisa and Dr. Colin Orr, or Colin, to begin the conversation and to tell us a bit more about themselves and the relevance of this topic to their current leadership and academic roles. So I'll begin with Lisa to tell us a little bit about her interest in this area, and thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Certainly, the topic is something that's near and dear to my heart. I am where I am today based on the shoulders of those that I've stood upon. I benefited from programs that were geared toward increasing representation in medicine, increasing representation in pediatrics. I spoke with a group of pre-med students a couple of weeks ago, and I gave my talk highlighting a lot of the no's that I had received along my path. Specifically, I am a native New Yorker. I was born and raised in Harlem. I actually still reside in Harlem. I was part of the New York City Public School System's Talented and Gifted programs. I transitioned to the private school realm through the A Better Chance program, a program that was geared towards increasing representation at some of the finest secondary schools in the nation. And, you know, some of the more resounding no's started then, but I persisted. I always remembered how important it was for me to reach back. So helped to recruit students to the A Better Chance program, went on to Harvard for undergrad, received multiple no's, went on to Yale Medical School, received more no's, went on to do my residency and fellowship at Columbia, the Children's Hospital, Morgan Stanley, received lots of no's then as well, started in a research position at Cornell straight out of fellowship, received many no's, But along the way, it was mentors, it was my family, a belief in the possibility of myself achieving, although I'd been told in many arenas that it wasn't possible. Always remembering to reach back. Those students, whether or not they were elementary school students, high school students, college students, medical students, residents, fellows, young faculty, kept me motivated to be able to be that yes for them. I'm currently the chapter president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, New York State Chapter 3. In that role, my mission was to bring equitable health care to the children of my city, my state, the nation. I also serve as district EDI champion for the AAP District 2. And in that role, I advocate for children who are not valued. And so it's just in me from as far back as I can remember, the importance of being able to lift up and advocate for those who are thought not to be capable. And so I can't say how thrilled I am to be a part of this conversation today.
Thank you, Lisa. I mean, we've known each other, but it is so incredible to listen again to your journey. And thank you for joining us. And Colin, like you to add your thoughts to sort of sharing a bit about yourself and then your academic role and how you view that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having the opportunity to present and share what I still perceive to be is a limited perspective. Hopefully it will grow in the coming, decades. So personally, I am a Midwesterner born and raised. So spent a lot of time in Ohio and Michigan, go Buckeyes. And then as my high school years ended, I decided I was really interested in kind of exploring this idea of what else is out there. And that led me to WashU for undergrad. I did make it to New York for med school, but that was before the name change. So my heart, it would still be the College of Physicians and Surgeons. and then it took me a while to get acclimated to the new name. Getting a little bit homesick, I wanted to go back and train at a large, rigorous program, and that led me to the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, affiliated with the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. It was really in that time that I began to see both the ability of clinical care to really impact care, but was also driven to understand these other factors that influence health that extended beyond the walls of the clinic or the hospital, where we spent a fair amount of time back in those days. And I really was interested in those factors, and then also how different communities influenced or interacted with those external factors, those factors outside the hospital. I at the time, there was across the classes maybe 120, 160 residents between categorical, prelim, genetics, et cetera. And there were two Black males. And so, Cincinnati serves a predominantly Black population. And in my continuity clinic is when I really began to see the difference in conversations, the openness, and really began to see how those systems outside the hospital really began to influence health. And as residency was coming to an end, I really was thinking about how can I maximize my impact? You can have a tremendous impact through your clinical care, but there's also an opportunity to gain skills that allow you to think about it from a systems perspective. And I felt that at that point in time, that was an ideal time for me and my family to take what at the time seemed like a really big jump and go to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and complete a primary care research fellowship. People usually chuckle when I say that you did a primary care fellowship after graduating residency. Yes, yes, indeed I did. And in that time, that's when I was really exposed to diverse mentors across the medical field, internists, med peds, family medicine, obstetricians. So to provide that context of how do other entities view pediatrics and the care that we provide, and also an opportunity to gain research skills. And as my career evolved and I completed my training, that's really where the bulk of my academic work has really focused on broad idea of thinking about health equity, but thinking about it currently in a more parallel avenue manner, meaning thinking about health equity as it relates to the pediatric workforce, but then also thinking about equity as it relates to the social environment that our children are living in that influence the conversations and the outcomes of those health conditions that we encounter and care deeply about while we're talking with families in the clinic. And how can we use data science to inform how our next approach, or how can we think about data and science to redesign, in some cases, in more extreme cases, redesign the way that care is delivered in order to bring the right care to the right family in the right way and in the way that's most beneficial or least intrusive to the families. So that's where I currently am. And I just recently moved from Chapel Hill to Vanderbilt.
Well, thank you for starting us off. I have to tell you, I'm going to resist the temptation to think back to my residency, but both what you and Lisa have sort of shared with us really spurs us to say that the journey in pediatrics is ongoing. And so I'm going to turn now to our council members, and please, both of you, chime in the conversation. But I didn't want the conversation to be grounded in the experience of this generation, which means reflecting that the council members certainly have long careers, but that to really be current with what's the current pulse of pediatrics, which is represented by the two of you. So the first question to the council is, and I'm going to ask Dr. Arnie Strauss and Bob Soren to comment on this. In your various leadership roles, what has stood out most as compelling reasons that medical students choose a career in pediatrics? And Arnie, if I could start with you in your reflections.
Thank you very much, Danielle. Colin, I would comment that I was chair at both Vanderbilt and Cincinnati. So I do am delighted that your experiences have led you to your current role. Both of your comments, Lisa and Colin, emphasize why the medical students go into pediatrics. The first is mentorship and a role model. So someone that you worked with, someone that interacted with you, who created a positive environment for you and motivated you to accomplish the things that you have accomplished. For me, that was also true when I chose pediatric. I think it's extremely common that is a motivator for students to go into pediatrics. I think the second common experience is something that happened during one's early years, whether it was interactions with one's own pediatrician, a sibling or a classmate in school who had a medical issue that motivated you to want to change the outcome for those individuals. So I think it's a question of mentors, role models, and life experiences that helped us all go into pediatrics. And then the third reason I would mention is service. And you have both mentioned this. We want to change the world for children. We want to make it a better place for the future. And those of us who have those ideals, I think, often go into pediatrics. We want to influence the future. Because I'm old, I can say this. You know, old people are not going to be around very long, but children are. And they're going to make a big difference in the future. So those are the three reasons, I think, Danielle, that motivate students to go into pediatrics.
Really appreciate Arnie's comments. I think they apply to those who are attracted to pediatric surgical specialties as well. A lot of it is, I think, the people who are motivated to choose pediatric surgical specialties, as Arnie mentioned, had some mentorship or some role model experience, not dissimilar to pediatric subspecialties. You have to go through your surgical residency or your otolaryngology residency and so forth. And you hopefully, part of that is a rotation at the local children's hospital. And when you get exposed to people, as I did at Boston Children's, who were just inspirational in their not only their skill and their knowledge, but their curiosity and their excitement about what they're doing. And this ethos that Arnie articulated so well about wanting to treat a generation that was going to live outlive you by decades. Those kind of experiences stimulate a lot of surgical residents. But what I found over the years is many of them have said to me, gosh, I love what you do. I would love to be a pediatric whatever. I just don't think I could deal with the parents and the stress and the angst and the sadness. And I'm always, I guess I'm not surprised, but I'm always disappointed because for me, those negative elements were far outweighed by the joy of what we did every day. I mean, working with kids, even those who are suffering from surgical conditions, can be in itself inspiring, just seeing how they deal with challenges and how they overcome the challenges. And then from a very sort of pedestrian mechanical perspective, the spectrum of diseases that one sees in pediatric surgical specialties is different. It tends to be more interesting. And we always, whenever someone's complaining in the operating room, I always used to quip, you know, hey, it could be worse. This patient could weigh 350 pounds. You just have kids who are fundamentally healthy and haven't destroyed their bodies with years of abuse. The technical part of children's surgery is always very enjoyable. So those are the things that I think attract people. But as I said, some people don't have the wherewithal to be able to deal with the family issues that go along with it. For me personally, I found that to be one of the greatest satisfactions of my career.
Thank you for commenting on all of those things. And obviously, the challenge is to integrate the family and the community and all of the things you've reflected. So I guess the next question kind of flows from this discussion is that what can institutions, all of us in this panel, Lisa and Colin, as well, have leadership roles, whether it's as mentors or, you know, near mentors and near peer mentors, is what can the institutions do to attract medical students to choose pediatrics? We are in challenging time. I did not take the time to kind of elaborate in terms of the difficulties in terms of pediatrics as a field now, in terms of the pediatric workforce. We've covered that in other Pediatric Insights. But what can institutions actively do to actually have folks choose pediatrics? And how can they, secondly, demonstrate their commitment to broad representation in an increasingly diverse child population? So let me have Craig, if you could start us off with some thoughts.
This is a very challenging issue. I think that we all realize that many of us are in situations where the number of underrepresented students or residents or faculty that we have really doesn't match up with the populations that we serve. And that really leads to poor medical care. And so we're all very committed, at least in my career, we've all been very committed to trying to address those problems. And I think that pediatrics has some real strengths that we can play on. One is, I think you need to look at and realize that residents and medical students talk, and they talk to faculty, they talk to residents, they talk to other medical students. And so you need to sort of look at, well, what is your toolbox as a leader in a health system, whether it be a department or a hospital, what is your toolbox that you can deal with to try and expose those medical students in a favorable way towards pediatrics? Well, one is the community in which you work. Outreach clinics, mini medical schools are all ways in which you can emphasize the importance of the underrepresented providers and the underrepresented populations that you serve. And I think that's something that oftentimes we don't really pay a lot of attention to. I think that the way that the institutions themselves treat residents and medical students is very important. Unfortunately, sometimes underrepresented medical students and or residents are treated inappropriately. And the way that the institution and the faculty members respond to those instances, how quickly they respond to those instances, the policies that you have on how that those situations are dealt with is a very important thing in helping underrepresented medical students understand that pediatrics indeed can be a field, which is a really important field and one that they want to participate in. I think you also have to look at the alumni. that you've had at your institutions, because medical students often pay attention to alumni that have had experiences, especially if those experiences are positive, in ways that you can try to make sure that the medical students understand that the institution is indeed committed to making sure that all populations underrepresented, as well as well-represented populations, are treated well, that they're treated respectfully, that they have good experiences, that the community they work in is very positive. So, and I think in summary, you just need to really look at what are those things that you have available to try and influence those medical students and realize that they really do have conversations with all components of the spectrum.
Thank you. And you are in an optimistic sort of tone of voice. So I'd like to challenge this discussion a little bit. And Bruder, I know the work that you've done in Seattle has been incredible. And if I remember something well from our Pediatric Academic Society's meeting, is your voice on the issues that we are now discussing. And I say that to honor the work that you've done. How does an institution actually go beyond talk of we? And I reflected as I was listening to Colin and Lisa, I was the only resident of color at CHOP in my year. And the reason I went was because David Nichols was the chief resident as the only person there. And David and Carolyn Yancey, who was a pediatric rheumatologist, were, and of course, I was impressed by the institution. I wanted Philadelphia, and I was impressed by all of the faculty. But the presence of those two individuals still stick in my head. And to this day, David is a friend. So, Bruder, can you comment on what institutions like yours, because you've done that at the national level, can do to actually show our commitment? And I'm going to challenge us a little bit more and say something. The social political context makes a difference, and it's tough now. So without delving into that too deeply, what are the things? And then we will discuss the challenges, because the data don't show that we've made that much progress. We've made some, but we haven't made that much progress. So Bruder, help us with this conversation.
Thank you, Danielle, for those kind words. I think that what I learned early on was that, you know, medical schools are, as in terms of an institution, they have an obligation to all specialties. So even if they're highly committed to inclusion and diversity, them focusing on pediatrics, you can't expect the school to selectively direct people to pediatrics. It's a responsibility of the Department of Pediatrics to lead those efforts, in my opinion. That doesn't mean that the institutions can't do things to enhance the opportunity for people to understand the joys of pediatrics. I think it starts with both in a department and national societies, the mission, their values, and their vision. When I had an opportunity to lead the APS, for example, I realized, you know, that I wanted to be a voice, but I didn't live the life of our colleagues who came from underrepresented communities. And so I've always, in my efforts, worked with people who did understand those communities and asked their advice. And we started with our values, led by our department. And I think that's important for the school as well. And I think the understanding that, you know, times have changed, people have changed, values have changed, society's changed. It requires people who are living those experiences to help lead and communicate the solutions. One of the things that has struck me that institutions should consider, and we did that to some extent in Seattle, was that the experience in pediatrics can be very traumatic. Often has been the primary site of education for pediatrics in medical school is in a children's hospital where most of the kids are desperately sick. The rounds are complicated. It's not necessarily a true picture of pediatrics in the community. And one of the things that institutions could do, in my opinion, is to get medical students at an early time into community situations where they actually see both the value of pediatrics to a community and also the joy of pediatrics seeing patients over a period of time. And in addition, having pediatric faculty, and hopefully the more diverse that faculty, the more successful it would be, participate in the teaching and interactions early in medical school. It's really difficult sometimes for institutions who have children's hospitals, where the hospital is not in the medical school itself, to have the faculty included in the teaching programs of the medical school. And the more interactions people have with pediatricians who have chosen this field because of the joy and the opportunity and the commitment to the future, all those things, I think, have a very important impact. When I was in Buffalo as chair, I had a summer program for first-year med students from a grant. And we every summer, I had 25 underrepresented medical students to Buffalo and with experiences in laboratories. But we also had social events. We had them come to Grand Rounds. We had them tour the hospital to get a real sense of the joy pediatricians have in their work and satisfaction. So those are some of the things. I think getting students involved outside the hospital into regional and community programs where they see the joy and not just the challenges of a busy, highly intensive care hospital.
I see some smiles from Colin, but I'm going to go to Bob a second because I think you had your hand up, and then certainly circle back to our guest speakers to see their reflections across kind of the generations in terms of new perspectives and why we're facing such challenges, despite the joy and the sense of belonging that Bruder has sort of shared with us. Bob?
Yeah, I don't know if Bruder was the person who originated this, but there was a summer program in Seattle for high school students from underrepresented minorities who had lectures and also had experience. And several of them came to Children's Hospital, and it was fun for us to have them because they were so enthusiastic and, you know, wide-eyed. And Bruder, I don't recall whether that was a medical school initiative or a community initiative, but I believe there were 25 to 50 students every summer. And it was, I think, a very successful program. And last I heard, many of those kids went on to go to medical school.
Yeah, Megan Marino started that program. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Colin, I saw you smiling, so I'm going to circle back to you when there were some of the comments, kind of your reflections about what kind of influenced you to choose pediatrics.
The word joy is, I don't know if you can say pediatrics without the word joy. And maybe a closely followed is one of potential. And I think there's like a, there's definitely individual characteristics and values associated with these ideas. But with pediatrics, there's this potential to alter the life course of a child, of a person, of an individual, so that they have the opportunity to achieve the best version of themselves. And I think that resonated with me. I am now an adult. I see an internist myself. But when I was in those settings, I felt less of that possibility. It was more, I've done this for 20 years, 25 years. I've had my three drinks, my two packs of cigarettes. Why after talking to you, would I change? And I think that those the differences in those conversations for me personally really spoke to, I want to be working on the preventative and the potential side of that life course. And I think at a certain point I'll use I statements, I began to recognize that the uniqueness of what I represented as a Black male pediatrician. I think I think data from the AMA says 3% of physicians are Black males. That number is even less in pediatrics. Our gender distribution looks slightly different. And then I thought to myself, what small impact could my visibility have? What small impact could my perspective have? And I think another thing, as we talk about the joy and the potential of pediatrics, I think another thing for us to consider, it would be great to maybe hear some others' thoughts on this, is I feel that we are at a generational divide a little bit. I think some of the motivators of myself and the more wise members of the panel may not resonate with our current generations who may be feeling different stressors. And I think the stressors are material. Medical school is super expensive. Pediatrics is not well compensated. That can come with a lot of financial stress, which can, in some situations, might obscure that the joy because there's other personal demands or stresses. And it might be hard for some individuals to want to go into a space where maybe certain individuals are more inclusive, but the system as a whole doesn't feel inclusive. Back when I was in high school, that's when the University of Michigan was taken to court over its affirmative action policies. And then we began to see a few years later the downstream consequences of that. And then now when I was at UNC, I was actually on my way out, but definitely felt the consternation of the campus and the community as once again, the Supreme Court was dictating how admissions can take place or should take place. And I think with the barriers that certain communities already face, having like a larger society, even if potentially driven by a few institutions, communicate either implicitly or explicitly, like we really don't want you here, can really just add like another barrier when there's already so many. So I think that there are joys, there are potentials, but it'll be important for us to consider what this current generation feels and how that might influence the choice.
Thank you for those comments. Obviously, the literature has shown that, unfortunately, that debt and the worry and the lack of inclusion often is a negative contributor to sort of the mentorship, which obviously both you and Lisa commented on. Lisa, do you want to weigh in on some of the thoughts here?
Sure. So as I looked at even the first question and the second question, two things come to mind. One is that little pictures have big ears and a lot of us strive for what we can see. I think about who are we trying to attract? Are we starting in college? Are we starting in medical school? Where do we start to be able to influence people to want to go into pediatrics? I think of all of the people who wanted to become a pediatrician because of their pediatrician. And then I think of my experience as a resident and what my resident clinic looked like. This is going to be a subject of a resolution I'm writing this year. I think it's very interesting that for resident clinics, children who come to those clinics have a pediatrician for 3 years. And then when that person graduates from residency, they get a new pediatrician and then so on and so forth. So that by the time they have reached adulthood and age out, they've had a number of pediatricians. That doesn't happen in a faculty practice. So when I say little pictures have big ears, when we have our trainees, we're telling them that having a two-tiered system is okay. For children who have government-sponsored insurance, it's okay to give them a different type of pediatric service. And I think sometimes just reflecting on who we are as institutions and what we say we stand for. I thought it was interesting in my residency for opposite reasons. One of my co-residents went to our program director and said, you know, I can't relate to these children in clinic. I want to go and see children in a private practice downtown Fifth Avenue area because those are my people. So it's the opposite is what I'm getting at here is that we become complicit when we say it's okay for the children in our resident clinics to have a new pediatrician every year. What are we projecting to the community? What are we projecting to trainees, to medical students who see our way of being? If we can inspire children in residents that this is an environment where as pediatricians, we stand for XYZ equitable care, I think we become more attractive. The newer generation, they are very, you know, cognizant of differences and seem to want to bring about social change. So I think allowing them opportunities within our AAP chapter, when we have advocacy day, the residents and those trainees show up because they want to be about something. They want to have meaning. So I think that we as leaders of institutions, of divisions, departments, we have to always reflect on ourselves and what we're projecting to trainees to be able to inspire them, to be able to inspire those future generations of pediatricians, whether it's starting with them being our patients at our institutions and extending to them being those trainees who come in for summer as high school students, as college students, and then evolves into medical students and residencies. We need to project meaning or something that people can get behind and say, yes, I want to stand for this. I want to advocate for equal care for everyone.
Lisa, obviously, you know, from many conversations, thank you both, Colin and Lisa, for telling us that we've got a long road ahead for equitable systems. We have a segregated system of healthcare, and it's evolved, and we don't have the time to go over this now. But it is very much, we're trained in one model. It doesn't align with what we're taught. We're running out of time in terms of the time for this, but I did want to ask Wesley, because Wesley Milliken, you're sort of putting this together in having a child advisory council, in recruiting leaders, and in being devoted to, I believe, changing the future. I wondered if you wanted to weigh in, and then I'll summarize for us. But the challenges are many in the current context, right? And I'm a child of the 60s and 70s and affirmative action in the Bakke case in UCLA when I was in medical student still rings in my ears. And so we have much ahead, but we have lots of hope with the kind of individuals who are represented in this panel. So Wesley, do you want to close us off in terms of your thoughts, or John, either of you, to close us off in our thoughts, and then I'll summarize.
Thank you, Danielle. Lisa and Colin, thank you for joining us. I learned that's exactly why we put the council together. I was struck by Bruder's comment of, while we can see issues, if we haven't lived them, it's hard to impact them as much. And so that's really a primary reason we put the council together, was to, you know, to be able to learn, because we work with leaders from diverse backgrounds on a daily basis. All of our clients want to increase the diversity of their programs. But the more we can understand it from Lisa and Colin and all of your colleagues, I mean, we are eager to do that. And I think it's in that understanding we can find opportunities to enhance what we're doing and to ensure the success of our diverse colleagues in the work that we do around the country. So again, just really wanted to express my thanks for the value you guys have added to the national conversation today.
Thank you all to the panelists, but I do want to close with some hopeful notes. Organizational justice is a term that's used by social scientists to suggest that we do have tangible steps that can begin to tackle the issues that Lisa and Colin have shared with us with respect to not only a sense of belonging, but a sense that a starting point must be one of equity, and that we must reflect that in our research, in our education, in our clinical care. You went over a number of things: mentorship, role models, the early years, the influence, the current status in terms of how education is actually supported in terms of, I think that it's about 200,000 to 250,000 in debt that many residents enter from their medical school and their education as undergraduates. You spoke of advocacy. I remember in my early days that what propelled me was that I was born in Haiti. I knew what bitter poverty was for a population, and that the motivation was, as Bruder said, to the values and the commitment to changing the world, which seems impossible sometimes. So we haven't solved the problems of the day today, but we have said that we reaffirm that pediatrics needs to talk and walk the same values, and that we're committed to doing that and recruiting individuals such as Colin and Lisa to leadership position, which they already hold, in changing the landscape for our children. So We have a lot ahead for this year and many years to come, but thank you for joining in this conversation. And in conclusion, we know that there are other pediatric conversations. Please visit our website at pediatricsinsight.com. And I want to thank all of us for engaging this conversation and continuing to challenge our thinking about what steps need to move us forward. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. If you have a question for our council or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by council specialty advisors who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30-plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients. Our council members include the following physicians: Bruder Stapleton, Christine Gleason, Craig Hillemeyer, Renee Jenkins, Danielle LaRocque Arena, Valerie Opapari, Bruce Rubin, Robert Sawin, and Arnold Strauss. To view our council members' bios, please visit careerphysician.com and click on the Child Health Advisory Leadership tab.